Tonight on Arena, Pat Short on his role in Mike Finn's new play Requiem, and Lollipop, Jane Austen, Wreck My Life and Tornado are the movies up for review. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch us on rte.ie/arena. I believe Pat Short is drying out in our Limerick studio as we speak, and we will be talking to him presently, but we're going to start with our film reviews first of all. And Declan Burke and Tara Brady are also drying out.
Yeah.
They're kind of dry, they say, at this point in time as we head into our film reviews. We're going to start with a Scottish Western. We'll have an ode to old-fashioned romance and a marginalised single mother. Laura Piani's Jane Austen Wrecked My Life is a truth universally acknowledged that a single woman in possession of a meagre fortune is not necessarily in want of a man. We'll hear more about that film later on. We'll get a dash of British social realism with Lollipop, which tells the story of a single mother whose children are taken into care because she is homeless. And Tara Brady and Declan Burke, as I say, have been to the cinema for us, but they're going to start with Tornado, a kind of a Western, I think you could say, with a twist. It's set in the Scottish Highlands. The hero is a young Japanese girl, and the director here is John McLean, who's brought us into a land like this before, Tara Brady.
Yeah, it's I suppose the genre, if we were going to give it a name, we'd say it was the deconstructed Western. I think that's we'll go with that because it makes it sound really clever. But yeah, and it's very similar in tone. If you remember Slow West, the glue was in the title. It was this very kind of slow, contemplative, sort of Western. I mean, Western certainly in its signifiers with Michael Fassbender, and this is similar, but it's throwing in another element. It's throwing in a samurai element into the mix, and it's also throwing in a little bit of like traveling circus type movies, which is a trope that we find again and again in the Western. This kind of the traveling show or the kind of roll up that type of thing. Although there's very very little kind of roll up razzmatazz, it must be said, about this particular traveling show. So the traveling show we have is kind of built around the main character who's Koki, who's in real life a Japanese actor and model, and she's a very kind of stoic
titular character,
quite sulky teenager.
Yeah, Tornado is her name.
She's with her dad, and there's a very kind of, you know, difficult teenage relationship with the dad, but they're quite close, and he also for some reason is in Scotland even though he's a former samurai turned puppet master, and together they have a kind of Punch and Judy type, you know, very violent kind of puppet show that they're travelling around the Scottish Highlands with.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, let's get a sense of that particular aspect of the film. Here we have Koki's Tornado introducing herself to a crowd who are watching very violent performances, it has to be said, for puppet shows. She's there alongside her father, Fujin, if I'm saying his name correctly, played by Takehiro Hira. He is an evil samurai in this particular puppet show.
Samurai warrior, flesh of little boys, and that drinks the blood of little girls. Which one of you will I devour today?
I'm Tornado, and I have come to avenge my mother, my father, and my unborn sibling. I'm Tornado. Destruction is my sole game, and I have come to destroy you. Your final feelings will be regret until the last flicker of light goes out and you drop down to hell.
Koki and Takehiro Hira as father and son, kind of puppet show samurai heroes in the midst of all of that. They are very violent, as I said, the puppet shows that we're watching, but the other violence that's happening right on the screen in front of us is Tim, another father, it's a father-son relationship this time, Sugar Man and Little Sugar, Tim Roth and Jack Loudon. You wouldn't want to be near that family, I wouldn't think.
No, pretty grim stuff. So the film opens with the character of Koki. She's running across, doing her best to get away across the Scottish moors. And you're wondering, what is this young woman running from? And suddenly this group of highwaymen on foot, but they have a relentless, dedicated trudging across, led by Tim Roth, as you say, Sugar Man and his son, Little Sugar, Jack Loudon. And they are single-minded. They are focused on this young girl. We discovered that she has stolen two bags of gold that belongs to them. Where they got it, we don't know. But they are going to get it back. And they burn, they kill, they just burn the whole place with impunity, because this, as Slow West kind of suggested, the first film that you referenced there, this is a place of lawlessness. This is like the Old West. There is no law and order for, you know, many, many miles in any direction. So there is a brutality, an almost inevitability to the violence as it is portrayed.
And it's a different, very different flavour from the kind of the puppet show thing. So I want to get a sense of that too by listening to a clip featuring the part of Kitten here is played by Rory McCann. And Tim Roth is Sugar Man, and he's divvying up the profits after a successful job. Jack Loudon, Little Sugar, not too happy with the spoils.
Should be enough to see us through to spring.
Right, some of you hang back with Sugar. Make sure we're not being followed.
Yeah. Right, get us to the safe spot and equal share as always. You have something to say, Little Sugar?
Well, the work wasn't equal, so why should the split be? Because I've forgotten what the hell did you do?
Equal split, as always.
Right, lazy legs, pick it up. And you, squid lips.
There we go. Jack Loudon as Little Sugar, Tim Roth as Sugar Man, and a character called Kitten, played by Rory McCann, in the midst of all this as well. So that, I think, is kind of more the tone of the overall film, Tara. But how do these elements of Japanese samurai, puppet show, Scottish Highlands, kind of Scottish cowboys and outlaws, how do they all mix together?
Well, they don't quite. I mean, like, the sort of elements are there. There's some very good actors here. There's some very good actors like Joanne Whalley who are not given nearly enough to do. And you have that kind of those mirrored, like, father-son, father-daughter relationships. And there's a really interesting dynamic between Tim Roth and the resentful son played by Jack Loudon. But it's a very dour film. And that's a real problem. I mean, it has a very sustained, very definite tone. And like our Irish cinematographer Robbie Ryan really leans into that sort of apocalyptic kind
so
of looking landscape.
Dark look off it.
You feel like it's about to rain on everyone and drown them. But a real issue for me is that if you're going to introduce things like samurais and westerns, you need to sort of think a little bit like Kill Bill or Samurai Jack or one of those, and have a bit of fun with them.
Stylizing
and this
of
is
that.
Not
stylized.
A fun movie. Yeah. This is a dour, heavy going movie.
Stars from you on this one, Tara.
It's a great idea, but I'm not sure it's brilliantly realised. Three.
Overall, did that those mix of elements work for you, Declan? I think you
Not the elements you described. They don't really gel. What I really liked was the blend of the landscape. We've talked about a very barren, bleak, and so forth.
And Robbie Ryan's cinematography picking up on that.
Terrific, and the way that mirrors the morality or lack of same of the outlaw is very, very well done. But as Tara says, the story itself is a bit one dimensional. So it's three stars from you.
By the way, I'm Richie Sinnott. Has been in touch by text 51551. Tornado sounds exactly like an episode of Zatoichi. Don't know if either of you know that. You agree. The Blind Swordsman is how that translates. From the 1970s, he embeds in a travelling circus to solve a problem. Fantastic shows. Well, you might be happier from the sound of things, Richie, keeping watching the Zatoichi episodes than going to Tornado, according to Declan and Tara, at any rate. Let's move on to film number two. Spoke to writer-director Laura Piani last night about her debut feature, Jane Austen Wreck My Life, hopefully not echoed by Leaving Cert students of the present and past. Declan, tell us, the bookseller here, Agathe, is the title of the character played by Camille Rutherford. Very romantic notions, but kind of very French, understated romantic notions in lots of ways.
But very practical too. She's not just a bookseller, Sean. She works in Shakespeare and Company in Paris, no less.
As did the director herself, Laura Piani.
Very good. But yes, so she, on one hand, Agathe is a bit of a romantic. She doesn't want to interact with the kind of modern dating world and its apps and so forth. On the other, she's very practical. She's just... her expectations are too high to allow her to just ascend to, you know, any old. And she has this kind of back and forth with her work colleague, Felix, who's played by Pablo Pauly. And she puts her feelings and so forth into words. She writes, starts to write a novel. Felix whizzes it away from her laptop and sends it off. And lo and behold, an invitation comes back from the Jane Austen retreat in the UK, offering her residency where she can come and explore her muse.
And here is the moment when she arrives in England. She gets off the ferry or whatever she's been on, and she's been picked up by a young man called Oliver. She's very keen not to get into the car, and very quickly throws up on him, as we will hear in this clip.
Agathe Robinson, it's me.
I'm sorry, I thought you'd be much older. I was asked to collect an elderly lady. I'm Oliver Lowe. I'll be driving you.
Is that your car?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, that's...
I must warn you about something. I'm really not comfortable when it comes to cars. It panics me to be in a car. It's... Sorry, my head is kind of spinning all of a sudden.
Are you all right?
I'm really sorry.
No, it's all right. These things happen.
Nice juice, by the way.
Thank you. Thank you.
Charlie Anson there as Oliver, the poor man with the dirty shoes now, and Camille Rutherford playing the character of Agathe from Jane Austen, Wrecked My Life. Would you describe the Agathe character as a very typical Jane Austen character or leading lady, Tara?
I think there's definitely some of Anne from Persuasion about her.
Yeah, because she compares herself to Anne Elliot.
And that's very much deliberate. And there's also that idea of, like, she's still a young woman, but she has this feeling that, like, she's missed the boat. She's missed the boat in romance. She's missed the boat as a writer. Mm. And that's true all the way of Persuasion, because I think, you know, she's sitting there from around, Anne in Persuasion is sitting there from about 24 going, oh, that's it, my life's over, I'm a spinster at 24, that's the end of it. So there's Laura Piani imports that, and it works really, really well, I think. And the other thing that, like, that kind of hinted at there is that she really has fun as well with the kind of franglais type dichotomy.
It's 70% French and 30% English, which I think is a funding issue.
But you end up, like, so Felix is, I mean, none of the characters are like the real cads in Jane Austen novels, like Mr. Knightley or Mr. Elton, or the kind of real pretentious guys that you just reject out of hand. Felix is a little bit slick, but he's kind of more of a ladies' man in the way that he's a French ladies' man. Like, they, you know, he just likes the ladies a lot. And then then Oliver is very kind of, is much more kind of English.
And I think
they have unreserved, and she has fun without that, without making it like, you know, onions and roast beef and berries and bowler hats. Like, she has really good fun with it.
And the mix of the two languages, I think, really helps that. But Tara's saying there, Declan, that the Felix character, who's the fellow who works with her in the bookshop, he's a friend of hers. He works in the bookshop, doesn't he? Yeah. And, you know, they kind of have you don't know whether they're just pals or whether they both want more or don't. Very different from the zipped up Oliver, who's that's very Jane Austen, very Mr. Darcy, very lots of Austen heroes.
Yes, yeah, and even has the right DNA credentials shown, because he is the great, 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 great nephew of Jane Austen herself, and he does have a brooding personality, and I think he was brooding even before.
And arrogant, quite arrogant as well.
And even
initially,
before Agathe got sick on his shoes. And he's kind of ruggedly handsome and so forth, and we know he's not necessarily morally a great person, because he thinks Jane Austen is overrated, Sean. So, I mean, what does that tell us about any man's character that might say that out loud? So he's, you know, he's rude, he's entitled and so forth. And this is all part of the kind of Austen narrative arc.
Is there enough fun in this for it to be a romantic comedy? It's quite understated humour, isn't it? Gallic humour, really.
Yeah, and I think there is, and I think there's lovely little things around the margins, like the fact that Oliver also has to take care of his parents and the father, who's quite like dowry,
and that's quite an Austen
and it's kind of, when you see and also then the Agathe has a sister, and she's very close to her sister, and that's a really kind of lovely thing that's kind of there in the background. But I love the fact that, like, if you do love Jane Austen, if you do love a rom-com, it still has things like, right, they're having a ball now and everyone's getting dressed up. It's like, that's there's all my boxes ticked right there.
Yeah, I asked Laura Piani about that last night. I thought the dancing was incredible in it. It's kind of used, like, there are dances to modern pieces, contemporary pieces of pop music, and there are also then dances that are more kind of 18th century reenactment balls, almost, because they are on this writer's retreat. It kind of mixed the contemporary and the historical in an interesting fashion, Declan.
It certainly does, and it makes a virtue of that. Little of it actually persuaded me, I have to say. I think the first third of the film, the first act, when Agatha is in Paris and she's, you know, completely inside, I think it works very well, her relationship with Felix. I think the storyline becomes a little stilted when she moves to the UK and so forth. It just felt slightly unconvincing. Charming, and as Tara is saying, and as you're saying, you know, they touch on many of the Austen tropes, but not, to me, in a very convincing way. For example, the classic Austen heroine is not a passive character. She might be constrained by her gender and so forth, but she is always actively...
And that society, yeah.
She's actively using what she can in order to manoeuvre out of her situation. And that seems very passive to me for the duration of this film. So I struggled slightly with that.
All right. Did it work overall in stars? I'll go to you first time, this time.
I wasn't convinced by everything, but it is charming. It's a nice rom-com. It's a 3-star movie for me.
Charming. And what are you saying, Tara?
I'm a little bit mad about it. And I think it's lovely, especially in the summer when it hasn't been a particularly brilliant summer for it. That's a real treat. So I'll go 4.
You're going 4 on it. That is Jyn Austen.
You old romantic.
Wrecked my life, but clearly not Tara's. But let's go to our final film then, Lollipop. This is about a single mother called Molly trying to get her kids back after a short stint behind bars. Let's have a listen to a clip, actually, which I think will give us pretty much the tone of the film. What's her name? Posy Sterling, rather, who's playing the character of Molly here. This is from the trailer, but we get a sense of the whole raft of pressures that she's under when she comes out of prison.
I'm going to see you in 3 days, okay? I love you.
Love you, Mummy.
I promise you, I'm going to see you very soon. I'm going to give you both a big squeeze.
We've taken everything into consideration, and we believe it's in the best interest of the children to keep them in foster care.
You're telling me, right, I can't look after my children because I've got no money, and then you're going to go and pay someone else to look after them for me, so riddle me that one.
We can't send them home with you if you don't have a home to go to.
Selection there from the trailer for Lollipop. Interesting. Daisy May Hudson, I should have said, is the director here, Declan. You get a sense of there are several catch-22s in this particular film and in the setup for the character of Molly. We get one there. So I have no money, but you're going to pay somebody else to look after my children.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's catch-22 meets Kafka because, you know, as you introduced us, Molly gets out of prison. She's in London. We're not told why she was in prison, but it was a 4-month stretch, so probably not that serious an issue. And when she gets out, she's living in a tent. And the big catch-22, she can't have her kids. She can't get her kids out of social service if she can't provide them with a home. And she can't get a home if she doesn't have kids to house. Now, that is would drive you absolutely insane. And what's complicating issues for Molly is that she had entrusted her kids to her mother, Sylvie, who is a functioning alcoholic. Oh, and then she doesn't know until she gets out of prison that Sylvie has literally just handed the kids off to the social services because she can't be bothered with minding two young children.
Daisy May Hudson, as I said, is the director here, Tara, and she has given us films of this ilk and certainly this kind of social realism, real echoes of Ken Loach, I would argue.
Yeah, no, well, Daisy, like, she first came to attention a few years ago in 2015 with Halfway, which was where it's a documentary about her own experience with her family. They were living in a small house in London, and a property developer came along and suddenly they found themselves falling through the cracks. And it's literally documenting their life, going in and out of hospital. hostels, like having had a very settled family life. She was in college at the time and had to come home from college and not do her final dissertation. So, and she went and documented the family's experience, and it became this like very powerful documentary. And you can see that authenticity in Lollipop, which again draws on some of the family's own experiences of going around offices and the kind of bureaucracy that they're met with. And I was really taken with like the phrase, like Declan was touching on some of it, where like the idea that because she was in jail, she has made herself intentionally homeless, is what she's told at one desk. Well, because you've made yourself intentionally homeless, then we can't do anything for you. And just it's so maddening and stressful to watch. And the only thing that saves it from being like, I guess, one of the kind of grimmer kitchen sink entries is that like Sylvie, the mother, isn't a terrible person either. Yes. There is a little bit of support from her, but there's also this like childhood friend, Amina, who's also having her own struggles with homelessness, who becomes a kind of support system. And it's that idea that there is a community around and that they will pull together a little bit like, and in fact, quite a lot like Ken Loach's I, Daniel Blake.
Yes, who had a similar type of issue around homelessness. Wasn't it homelessness that was his issue as well? I should say Sylvie, the mother, played by Terry-Ann Cousins, and Idi Ahmed playing the character of Amina. Posy Sterling plays the character of Molly, and we've talked about this realist style, comparisons with Ken Loach. That's the style of acting we're getting here. There's a rawness to it, Declan.
Oh, absolutely, Sean. Scraped back to the very bone by circumstances. You know, she's coming out of prison and physically she's slightly wasted by the experience and so forth. But as to stress, and this film just sent my stress levels through the roof watching this, but she seems to almost tauten as the process of the film goes on into a single humming string. Sorry.
When you say that it set your stress levels very high, what was it about the story that was stressing you out?
Well, look, I think anybody with a scintilla of humanity will empathise with Molly's situation. I think if you have, especially if you have kids of your own and you try and, you know,
imagine
put yourself
the situation.
In her situation and so forth, but also the implacable bureaucracy and the, you know, the Kafkaesque nature of it. And at one point, one of the social services characters says, you know, don't start, you know, knocking your head against the wall or something, a phrase like that. And she just erupts, Molly erupts and says, show me where to punch. Show me where to put my head. You know, she's just begging them to show her what the one thing she can do that can help help them to help her, and it's the sheer frustration of it, Sean.
Yeah,
and actually, if you're in any way empathic character,
human beings will be affected.
I think so.
Yeah, and it's clear from the way you're saying that I could feel the frustration actually that you were sensing her, and you're nodding in agreement, Tara.
Oh yeah, no, definitely. And it's like the her performance as well is so, Posy Sterling's performance is so precise. Like everything about, like physically, she's just you almost stress like what looking at her on the screen. You can see, like, you can see the tension in her body, like building, particularly in these exchanges. And there's also just like there's a degree of carelessness as well. Never mind the bureaucracy. Like the first time she's reunited with her kids, only one of them turns up because the other one's at an appointment. And it's like just this kind of like, and then she only sees the daughter for a minute, and you're like, that's so careless. And you know that someone who hasn't seen their kids in 4 months has to go through that, like re-traumatized.
And just briefly, you know, there is a bleakness. Obviously, it's not, there's no happy story really being told here, but is there any scintilla of hope for the characters and for society as we come to the end of it, Declan, and Stars, as you're telling me that?
I think as a film, Sean, it doesn't pull any punches as a social realism film, and it shows us exactly what can go wrong when bureaucracy becomes blind. But as Tara alluded to earlier on, the relationship with Amina, particularly your old school
friend
who she reconnects with and is good, that tells us that, you know, it's something like, you know, it takes a village to raise a child. There is a sense of community that allows for a slightly softer landing than might otherwise have been possible. I thought this is brilliant, fantastic ensemble performances, 5 stars from me.
Tara?
Oh, 4.5, really high, really good.
Really good, really good, 4.5 and 5 respectively. For Lollipop there, we also spoke about Jane Austen Wrecked My Life and Tornado. Tara Brady and Declan Burke, our reviewers on this Thursday evening. No, absolutely delighted to have the multi-award-winning actor, comedian, showrunner, musician, musicologist, and might I suggest national treasure, Pat Short, in our Limerick studio. How are you, Pat?
How do I work after that? That's an intro.
That was only the first three lines. I have another 15 to go. I was saying at the top of the programme, our reviewers, Tara Brady and Declan Bourke, were in saying how wet it was outside. I was saying you needed a little bit of time to dry off after the vagaries of rehearsal at the moment. Let me tell people what you are doing.
Yes.
You're playing this play called Requiem, which is you're a local record shop owner. The shop is called Desi's Disc. Desi is the owner. He has an encyclopedic brain for all things musical. So this and yes. He used to play the saxophone.
Yeah, there you go.
He used to play the saxophone. It says here, and it says in the script, in a not very successful band, but we'll just say he used to play the saxophone for your sake. Now, you're a maker of documentaries. You're a musician. Yeah. You play you still play the saxophone.
I do, DJ, yeah.
But when I think of Songs of Ireland with Mike Hanrahan of Stockton's Wing and Entertainment from the Telly and the kind of things that Desi is talking about and loves in Requiem, kind of sounds as if who else could play this part but Pat Short.
Listen, it was written for me, Mike will always say, because he couldn't pay anybody else as low as he pays me to do it. But it is a bit, yeah, like I've been involved in it. I suppose Mike wrote it about 8 years ago or so, and it's many drafts as happens in when you're working on a play. But I've kind of been in at the start with the readings with him and everything else, and it's just wonderful to see it now getting up on the stage eventually, you know. And it is. Yeah, so I suppose the saxophone piece, Mike knows I play sax and the whole lot in there, so it was kind of a little nice little piece put in there for me, you know. But the character of Desi is I suppose it's kind of lamenting a bit of the way has gone, shopping and retail and all that kind of thing with music and the onset of Spotify and all these kind of things. And he mentions them in the show, you know. I mean, there's a great line in it about, you know, you can join Spotify anytime, anywhere, and six songs later you're listening to Michael Feck and Buble. So that kind of sums it all up.
Yeah. It really, there is a real sense of nostalgia about it, and nostalgia for that kind of one small town had its record shop, but if you went to the next small town, it was a different record shop with a different record shop owner and a different set of musical tastes. Did you have a place like that yourself growing up?
I did, actually. Do you know what? When you look back on it, there was a small record shop in Turles when I was growing up. It's many, many years it's gone. There was one or two, but there's one particular I remember. And I remember getting picking up, and the guy was very into his music, and I don't know where he was getting his selections from, and it was vinyl at the time. Mm. And I picked up the Million Dollar Quartet album, which is actually an extremely rare album. It's an album by Johnny Cash, Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, and I can't remember the fourth one. But they did kind of gospel music. And I remember reading years later that there wasn't that many of them printed, and it was a very rare album. And somehow it ended up in Turles in a record store, and I ended up buying it new. So the guy had an interest and a passion for a record shop. And I think anybody that runs a shop like that, or like a vintage clothes shop or something, they have to be in there passionately, because there mightn't be a huge lot of money made off it, but they're making a living. But it's kind of like a niche, isn't it?
Yeah, there is a touch of that involved in it. And the way you're describing it there, you know, yes, clearly Mike was thinking of you when he wrote the part, and Mike would have worked with you on Killing Scully.
Many projects.
Yeah, maybe you were talking about it at those times. Were you involved with Mike then in actually developing the piece and establishing the character of Desi and the different ideas around him?
Not really so much. I mean, Mike is the writer first and foremost. But look, I probably influenced him. We both are like-minded individuals in the sense that we do think the same. And I suppose we both would have been of that generation of vinyl. Yet that said, we did a photo shoot yesterday in a record shop in Limerick. And the one thing I said it to Mike today, the one thing I noticed was all the customers that came in were all young people. So while you might think it's nostalgic and us and our generation looking back, reminiscing of the vinyl and everything else, there's a whole new vinyl scene out there, and it's vibrant.
Yeah, and in fact, that comes up. I'll come back to it later on. In one of the, there is a younger character here.
Correct. Yeah.
Chantelle, isn't that her name? Yeah, Chantelle, who's 17, doing the Leaving Cert, and certainly not doing too much around the Leaving Cert, which would have to be said. But that we'll come back to her a little bit later on. Music plays such a central role to the way the play is realised. Let's start by how the play starts. In fact, it starts with this Bob Dylan track.
Well, I'm sailing on back, ready for the long haul, tossed by the winds and the seas. I'll drag them all down to hell, and I'll stand them at the wall. I'll sell them to their enemies. I'm a-trying to feed my soul with thought, gonna sleep off the rest of the day. Sometimes no one wants what you've got, sometimes you can't give it away. Now the place is ringed with countless fools, some of them may be deaf or dumb. No man, no woman knows the hour that sorrow will come. In the dark I hear the night birds call, I can feel a lover's breath. I sleep in the kitchen with my feet in the hall, sleep is like a temporary death. Meet me at the bottom, don't lag behind, bring me my boots and shoes. You can hang back or fight your best on the front line, sing a little bit of these working band blues.
Working man's blues, of course, there from Bob Dylan. And that is how well, certainly in the
starts,
the version of the script that I have thrown my eyes across, that is how the film, how the play starts, and these things change a lot. But how do you think that particular Bob Dylan track sets up the world that we're heading into in this play, would you say, Pat?
Well, I think in the opening sequence, the character Desi walks out and he's washing his teeth, and he's just about to, that's on the radio very, very low, and then he suddenly hears the construction kicking around him. And for people out there, the premise of the play is that the development is coming in around Desi's shop, and he's the last one standing, and he's holding out, and he turns up that music. And I think it's the one thing that's said in the play, that the character Desi talks about how music is laid out on albums. It's not random like Spotify, that'll jump around, or an algorithm pick it out, but people, when they put an album together, worked hard to pick out the tunes, and there's a story in the album if you listen to an album. And I would like to think the same as what Mike has done with the play, that the music in the play, it is a story to it. And in this case with the Working Man Blues, it's Desi's a working man. He's struggling to keep his work, his shop together and everything else. And it's a nod to that, in the sense of the opening of the play is his story.
Yeah, and in fact, a little bit later on into the play, we get a specific argument around this particular track.
So bright, there's evil in the air, and there's thunder in the sky, and a killer's on the bloodshot streets. Oh, I'm down in the tunnel with a deadly horizon. Oh, I swear I saw a young boy down in the gutter. He was starting to foam in the heat. Oh, baby, you're the only thing in this whole world that's pure and good and right. And wherever you are and wherever you go, there's always gonna be some light. But I gotta get out, I gotta break it out now, before the final crack of dawn. So we gotta make the most of our one night together. When it's over, you know we'll both be so alone.
Bad Out of Hell, of course, from
from Meatloaf.
Pat Short speaking to me from our Limerick studio this evening. about Mike Finn's new play Requiem. And that Bat Out of Hell, the whole argument is it's there's another pal of Desi's who's in the shop with him. Paulie is his name, isn't it?
Yeah.
And they're talking about this, and another old friend of his, Finton, a property developer, who's kind of wants the space that the shop is in, get rid of the shop and use the space. But that argument around how an album is constructed is very interesting in the play, Pat. Are you still an album listener? Do you have time to do that?
I have vinyl, and that's one of my actually all-time favourite albums, I have to say. And I was lucky enough to play support to Meatloaf years ago in Tralee. Myself and John Kenny, we had a band at the time called the Cattle Dealers Lament. And we were on the bill, which was, anyway, that box was got the T-shirt and everything else. But
on the bill with Meatloaf?
Yeah. We played earlier on. It was fantastic. So it was definitely a box-ticking exercise. Yeah. But yes, of course. I mean, I'm a very eclectic music person. I listen to absolutely everything. And I do have vinyl. I have my stereo in the house. And I've actually records I have since I was a kid. I have boxes of them. I got big into jazz and stuff like that. And there is that story, in especially in Meatloaf, actually, in particular that album, because I think it went on to be a stage production afterwards, or it may have emerged from a stage production. I think it actually did and became a big rock and roll thing. But there was a story about the guy meets the girl and all that kind of stuff, and it's fantastic. And yes, I have to say, there is something about putting an album on in your house if you're cooking or whatever it is, and letting it run through. And it really builds, and the whole, it's like a show, and then flipping it over and getting the second side. You don't get that from Spotify and stuff like that. There's lots of great things with Spotify, don't get me wrong, but that is definitely, the making of an album is something else.
Yeah, I mean, even that, I often think of, the moment when, and even when the CD came in, that was, that changed. That moment when, whatever it would be, track 5 or 6 on side one, and then you'd flip over the vinyl, there was something, it was almost like it was like an interval, and here comes the second act,
yeah. And with singles, A side, B side, all that kind of stuff, I mean it was definitely a by design,
Oh, here, listen, who's this? It's Ger Lynch in Glasnevin. Million Dollar Quartet is a recording of an impromptu jam session involving Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, Carl Perkins, and Johnny Cash, made on December the 4th, 1956, at the Sun Record Studios in Memphis, Tennessee.
Yeah.
Not such a rare album. It's available on CD, he tells us too, but you won't get to...
Vinyl, we're talking vinyl.
Yeah.
Original cut.
Yeah, you have to get...
for him.
Ger Lynch in Glasnevin, but he does say he is a vinyl and CD junkie, so he wants the physical element in his hand. Just come back to the saxophone thing, Pat.
Yeah.
Because I mean, I'm thinking of you and Mike Hanrahan of Stocks and Swing, of course, and you with the guitar in your hand for Songs of Ireland going around with Mike, which I believe is that going to be a live show? Are you working on a live version of that?
We did a small tour last year with it before Christmas last summer we did it, and it was amazing. I mean, it was another box taking exercise for me. I started life as a musician, but never really played with a band or toured with a show. And that show with Mike was incredible. And he's an amazing arranger, as well as a musician and a writer. So it was just lovely to work with Mike Hanrahan. It was incredible.
And what then, you're playing the guitar and that, and I think you're a multi-instrumentalist. You can play a few different things. But the saxophone seems to be the one that kind of grabbed your attention most. Why, how, and where, and when?
I don't know. I'd love to give you a lovely, eloquent answer to that. I was inspired by Paul Desmond and some solo he did or something like that. But basically, I was an 80s young fella. And if you go back to the 80s, there was a saxophone in every band. And there was a girl I was interested in. She was into, I think it was it not Depeche Mode or one of them? So I picked up the sax. Now, I had played the flute before that, and there was a sax in the house, and I picked it up. But I loved it, and I got into it in a big way, and I learned jazz and all that kind of carry on, and I just absolutely loved it. And I love Paul Desmond, who was West Coast kind of stuff. Like, a lot of guys are into Brecker and East Coast kind of bop jazz and that kind of stuff. I love the kind of laid-back West Coast style, and I think Paul Desmond they asked him once, how did he like his saxophone to sound? And he said he liked it to sound like a double dry martini. And that had me won over straight away.
Yeah. I want to play that instrument. Says you. Going back then to the, I suppose at the centre of the play really is this whole idea of development. It's Requiem, as I, you know, when you see it written down, it's different because it's spelled W-R-E-C-K, and there's a big wrecking ball on the picture of the script that I saw, probably a part of the design, I'm guessing as well, in terms of the stage production itself. It's hard to reconcile, or I suppose, how do you, Pat, reconcile this idea of we do need things to progress and sometimes things do have to change, but how do we manage to do that without throwing out the baby with the bathwater?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that we tap into in the play a bit. Like, of course, you have to move on. You can't just sit around and do all things. But I think a large part of what the play is about is relationships as well, and friendships. And that kind of is more, I think it looks at that and how much things mean to people, more so than just being a record shop, but it's a place where people come together, and it's like a sanctuary for them and that kind of thing. And it brings in oddballs, people that might not be accepted in other places, but this is a very acceptable place for them. And the fact that that's going to be gone it upsets the fabric of their life, and I think that's what it's about, more so than just the fact that we need to get rid of albums and move into CDs, and downloads are easier and it's better, and you don't have to have a big bot press full of stuff. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
that's the practicality and the
yeah. Because you mentioned the character of Chantelle, who's the 17-year-old character doing the Leaving Cert, as I say, but spending a lot of time in the record shop rather than anywhere else, and she brings in Wrecking Ball and Miley Cyrus. She is that
contemporaries.
She brings that in. Like, are we just at the point now where we look back at the music that was so important to us in our youth and at specific points in life, and it kind of brings back memories? I mean, will they be talking in 20 or 30 years' time to, do you remember Spotify? Wasn't that a great old thing?
Of course they will. I mean, I hear my kids who are in their 20s talking about tunes that they listened to and, oh my God, when they were, you know, 13 or 12, and the daftness and the gear they used to wear and the clothes. I mean, that's the same as what we talk about.
Yeah.
Going back to when the Sky Euro was there, that was my thing. Or if the heavy metalers up the road and the jackets used to wear, and we used to all get our stuff on markets and suits and socks, and we used to dress up like the guys in the specials and that kind of stuff. It's every generation has their own era and their own time. Yeah. You know.
Pat is a living legend. He is Ireland's Bob Dylan, says Clare and Cove. There you go.
Oh, thank you very much, Clare.
I don't have a name on this one, but if Pat supported Meatloaf in the late 80s or early 90s in Horan's in Tralee...
That's it, that was the gig.
Well, this texter was there. I hadn't thought about those gigs in years, but what wonderful fun we had in very different times.
Very different.
There you go. You know, I suppose in many ways what the play addresses is this whole idea of the price of a thing, the value of a thing, the value of a shop like that versus the price of the value and the price of the land that it's on and the space that it is within.
And the meaning it has to people, And the likes of that young girl, Chantelle, the character, she's probably a bit odd and probably not accepted by her own bunch in school, maybe having problems there or something. And she finds warmth from these oddball older people and crack and daftness, you know, and that's great.
Listen, I just want to finish with a teeny little bit of Rory Gallagher. Tell me where Bought and Sold fits into the story, and then I'll let you go.
Well, Mike is a big fan of Rory Gallagher and Horselips and various acts. And Bought and Sold is I suppose it's a track in the shop that's played on thing. And when my character comes in, he says, "I'm feeling bought and sold." And I think the developer thinks he's talking in a different way.
Yeah. Well, listen, great to speak with you, Pat. Best of luck with the rest of rehearsals. I'll play a little bit of Bought and Sold, and I'll give people the details of when and where they can see Requiem shortly. Great to talk to you, Pat. All the best.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, feeling bought and sold. Just a little flavour of Rory Gallagher there and that song that is at the heart of the themes, I suppose, of Requiem, the new play by Mike Flynn that Pat Short was telling us about. The play is directed by Andrew Flynn and it will be playing at the Lime Tree Theatre in Limerick from June the 25th through until July the 5th. Oh, and breaking news from the world of books that I should share with you now, the announcement of the winner of the Women's Prize for Fiction, formerly the Orange Prize. The winner is the Dutch writer Yale van der Woude for her novel The Safe Keep, which is about a family in the aftermath of the Second World War dealing with how people behaved during that time. The winner of the Women's Prize for Non-Fiction was awarded to Rachel Clark for the story of a heart which has been described as a clear-sighted, vital exploration into the human experience behind organ donation, and congratulations to both winners, their fiction and non-fiction. There we have it. Love is the Drug from Roxy Music. The year was, Pat Carty sitting in front of me?
1975, of course, Sean.
1975 was the year. And this is the year that has been treated in the book, The World, the Year the World Forgot, which comes from Dylan Jones. And he is suggesting, Pat Carty, that people think nothing happened in 1975 in terms of music, and indeed in terms of culture, but he's arguing that something did. Lots of things did.
Yeah, he's arguing against this this kind of thing from punk, from the years of punk, which is maybe the next year, 76, where they said, it's year zero, right? Nothing worthwhile at all ever happened before the Sex Pistols' first record or the Clash's first record. Now, he stands and he obviously says, you know, if Tinney's dedicated a whole book to it, obviously he doesn't agree with that. It's kind of, that's a critical viewpoint that's died, thankfully, in the last 10, 15 years, 20 years more. And you can tell by the records that he's picked here and the variety of them that 75 was a fantastic year for music.
Yeah, I mean, was it only that punk statement that, you know, oh, well, nothing happened before us? Was that the only reason that 75 was maligned, or was it maligned by others as well?
Well, there's I had to use a four-letter word before the watershed, but there's prog rock, and which is an abomination, always was. Yes, doing triple albums and things like that. And also, I suppose if anyone has seen that Top of the Pops 2 that is on sometimes on the television, and they go along and they pick a year and they put it on, and of course there's awful garbage, but you could say that about any year.
I was going to say you could hardly pick a year that there isn't some garbage. This is from 1975. Born to Run, of course, from Bruce Springsteen, from the year 1975, which is the year treated in the book The World, The Year the World Forgot, which Pat Carty has been reading. And did it send you back, Pat, to listen to many of the records that Dylan Jones suggests you should have listened to if you didn't in 1975?
Well, it did. I mean, I started school in 1975, so I wasn't listening to a lot of Bruce Springsteen back in 1975, I'll be honest with you, or Bob Dylan or Joni Mitchell or anything of the sort. But what it did do for, I mean, because of you know, as you know, I've been on here plenty of times, and what I do for a part of my living, I do know a lot of these records very, very well. And but there was one or two that I didn't know at all. Keith Jarrett.
Yeah.
The jazz pianist, the Cologne
concert,
Is that how you pronounce it? Cologne, I presume it is in English. I'd heard of that record before, but I hadn't heard it.
Of course, it's a live performance.
And I sat down to listen to that while I was reading this, and it's astoundingly good. And the story behind it is fantastic, that he turns up at this thing. He was tired. He was touring. He's about 27, 28 at the time. A young student who was organising the show had got a piano for it, and it turned out to be a rehearsal piano. It wasn't the one he wanted at all. He says, I'm not doing the show. And he goes off, and she comes out in the rain, like this evening, and goes to the car, knocks on the window and begs him to come in and do this. So he said, I'll do it for you. And he goes in and does it. And he said his approach was, the whole thing was using the restrictions and of the instrument to drive him on. And when you listen to that record, as I did for the first time doing this, you can hear him shouting and roaring and kind of inventing a new language. And you know, and there was a few other ones like that on the list that I wasn't familiar with.
And I mean, we played a bit of Roxy Music at the top, and you say that Siren is your favourite Roxy Music.
It is
album.
My favourite Roxy Music
today.
Album.
It might be different
today. I mean, the other thing I disagree with, he says David Bowie is. David Bowie's Young Americans is David Bowie's first record. Sure, everybody knows that's not, or his best record. Everybody knows that's not true, you know. And I think he picks in the book Bob Dylan's Blood in the Tracks is the best record. But I was listening to an interview with him, and he picked David Bowie's one. And he said Joni Mitchell's Hiss in the Summer Lawns is better than Hejira or you know, that's just not true.
But might you feel something different about those tomorrow, do you think, or another
well,
day?
Well, no, don't get me wrong. They're fantastic
great albums,
records.
They're not
and it's lovely. Yeah. And I really like Dylan Jones, and I really like the way he describes it and he tells stories around it. So if someone was looking, isn't it Father's Day this weekend?
It is.
It is, yeah. So I would suggest that people, if your father is a man of taste and
musical
distinction,
taste, yes.
get down to the shops and get Dylan Jones.
Are you dropping a hint for yourself, sir?
Which I think is, well, I've got it already, obviously, they sent me one.
and from your even having read the book, is your favorite album, is your own favorite album or top album from 1975 in there, and what is it?
Well, there are a few that aren't in there. I was talking to Ollie outside. Ollie was talking about Kevin Ayers' Sweet Deceiver, which isn't on the list, which I haven't heard in a long time. Night at the Opera by Queen is another, I like that record a lot. Marcus Garvey by Burning Spear. You know, there's Who by Numbers, that's not there. But of the ones he picks, like, you can't go wrong with Blood on the Tracks. You can't go wrong with Born to Run. You can't go wrong with Hissing the Summer Lawns. You know, they just are
and
great
the
records.
The section on Physical Graffiti, Led Zeppelin's Physical Graffiti, I think is particularly good, is it?
Yeah, for God's sake. His whole page is about the party that was launched to do it. So people turn up for the party. First of all, and this is very 1975, it's in a set of caves. It's not in a hall or anything like that. It's in a set of caves. And you turn up and there's a load of young fellas dressed as medieval yeomen, first of all. Right? That's first of all, you see that, holding tiki torches, and then you go inside and there's a lot of there's various couples of naked young women in coffins now, filled with jelly, wrestling. And then you go further in, there's dwarfs, can you say that, is that the right word, short people tumbling around. And then in the corner, George Melly's jazz band are playing. Wow. And that's the launch of the record. You know,
well, read that and then listen to the record.
There you go.
You'll have a good night. A book worth getting, even if you don't know it's 1975, is it a good way to open up the music of that era for you?
I would think so, yeah. Dylan Jones is always an astute commentator. He's written many, many books, and some about David Bowie, a great one about, he wrote a whole book about Wichita Lineman, just the one song, which is fantastic. But yes, he's a great commentator on this. He picks great records. He's great things to say about Steely Dan or Patti Smith or, you know,
Dave Brubeck,
jazz rock. No, he Return to Forever is who he picks. And he says jazz rock is a bit like Tabasco. It's effective in very small doses.
Well, thank you for that. I'll remember. Thanks to Pat Carthy. 1975, The Year the World Forgot by Dylan Jones, is published by Constable. That's our lot for this Thursday evening. Liam Murphy researched. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Ruth Kennington was on sound. And tonight's programme produced by Sian O'Gorman. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.